supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Are politics in our genes? That's G-E-N-E-S. It seems standard political science models focus on environmental factors to explain our politics. But today's guests say the truth might be in our DNA as well as our environment. My guests are Avi Tushman and Pete Hatami. Avi Tushman is an evolutionary anthropologist. He's the author of his new book, Our Political Nature, The Evolutionary Origins of What Divides Us, and he joins us by Skype. Avi, welcome to Voices.
Hi, Dan. Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. Pete Hatami is a Penn State University Associate Professor, Political Science, Microbiology, and Biochemistry. He's co-author of Man is by Nature, a Political Animal, and he joins us by phone. Pete, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we'd like to hear from you, our listeners. Our number is 888-477-9499. Where do your politics come from, do you think? Do they come from information? Do they come from your childhood? Or do you think you're hardwired this way? Again, 888-477-9499. Avi, let's start with you. Everybody knows about how polarized and frankly paralyzed Congress is. But from what I've read and researched, we all seem pretty stagnant in our political ideology. We surround ourselves with friends who reinforce our own ideology. We watch TV stations that do the same. How did we get this way?
Well, political orientation comes from different sources. Some of it seems to be from our innate dispositions, and also our environments do play a role as well. What's a bit surprising to people is study after study shows, for example, when you look at twins who've been separated at birth, and you can look at identical twins versus fraternal ones, and we can see that a much higher the degree of the variation in people's political attitudes comes from genes, and a lot of people would think. So the heritability, depending on the studies, anywhere from 40 to 60%.
Really? So one of the themes in your book is just this, that they're molded by evolutionary forces, but does that mean we're powerless? Is biology destiny? I guess I want to go on, Avi.
I don't think at all that we're powerless. I think we do have free will. It may be a bit less than we think sometimes, but it's very important that we remember that we do have free will. And the question that I'm getting at is, what is the deeper underlying structure? The problem is that we already all have intuitions because we're in a globalized world and we're reading headlines from all over the world. And we know that certain issues, take gay marriage, for example, we already know that this is polarizing political spectrums everywhere in the same way. And yet there hasn't been a proper explanation of why a left-right spectrum runs through populations all over the world, and how it's structured.
Dan, I might be able to step in for a second. Hey. It's really important to know that there's no gene for being liberal or conservative, or even thousands of genes for being liberal or conservative. And we're not really hardwired for anything. If we're hardwired for anything, it's to be really adaptive. It's to be able to change to our circumstances and our environment and our local ecology. It's that people differ in their DNA, and that difference gives them some general inclination about how they approach the world, how they process information, and the peer groups they select into. And like Ivy was saying, that there's two elements, and it's really complex. There's one is this evolutionary reason why we have attitudes. It's like, why would we care about sex and mating and war, and that all populations across all cultures and all times, they care about these same kind of basic issues, although they are expressed differently in different places. And then why do we differ in those? So in America, you have a lot of freedom to have attitudes, and you see enormous variation. Where in the Middle East, you have a lot less freedom, and it doesn't mean that culture or environment or the family environment that you're in is not ultimately important. It's huge. Actually, the culture and the life that you live can repress all genetic differences. Living at home with your parents is a great example. You really don't have a lot of freedoms as a child. Your parents take you to the churches and religion they have. You are socialized into your political group. It's not like you can express yourself. But then when children leave home, they go to college, they start to experience new things, and they start to drift away from home, and their own genetic proclivities come in and give them kind of a general inclination of environments to select into, people to select into, and processes to experience. So if there's any message to get out, it's certainly not that we're hardwired to be left or right. It's that if we're hardwired for anything, it's to be able to adapt. And we tend to have these general inclinations about how we view the world, about how our emotions are processed, about what we prefer, and tend to select into those and reinforce those. So it's this constant interplay with nature and nurture, never really one over the other.
I'm curious about something, Avi, you brought up, and Pete, you touched on, and that's the issue of gay marriage. And that does seem to divide us worldwide. Pete, you talked about our being hardwired for adaption. So you brought up issues of, you know, sex, mating, and war. Well, that makes sense. I mean, from our evolutionary genes. But why something like gay marriage? What does that touch in our evolutionary genes? Why do we care?
Oh, anything having to do with access to mates, about sexual norms, those are found in every society. And so certainly that, that while gay rights, it seems only like a complex downstream, social and economic issue, it's any of those kind of sexual issues really hit home in across societies. And then some societies repress it so greatly that any expression of homosexuality could be a death sentence. And others, it comes out as the ability for marriage. And so where the governments that you're in and the culture you're in, they set the stage for how that issue is discussed, you'll still find great variation in peoples in those societies, but then you'll find that everyone has an attitude on it. Like things like abortion, gay rights, death penalty, very few people have no attitude. Maybe water purification, lots of people have no attitude.
I want to come back to this issue I addressed with you, Avi, in the beginning about how paralyzed our Congress is. Now, maybe I've got a narrow lens, but I've never seen a Congress in my lifetime this paralyzed, this frozen, and I wonder what's going on over the historic spectrum that's causing us to be this stuck. And I also wonder if it's an American problem, or does this go hand in hand with democracy?
Well, one thing that we're seeing right now in America is we're still recovering from the economic crisis from a few years ago. And research shows when you look at all the countries in the world and their GDP per capita, how well their economies, how wealthy they are or how poor, you find that that has an important impact, a very strong correlation on the breadth of the political spectrum. So,
for example, give us an example there, Robbie. What do you mean?
So, for example, if a country is under a lot of economic stress, if it's a poor country, you tend to find a much broader political spectrum with a far left maybe and a far right. And to the on the other side of the coin, when a country is growing or prosperous, you find much greater political moderation. So Brazil, which has raised about a sixth of its population up into the middle class in recent years, has had a narrowing of the political spectrum. So there's still some ideological differences to the left and the right, but there's a lot more continuity. And to get back to your question, in the United States, when we're under economic pressure from the crisis, and this changed people's expectations and their day-to-day reality, that's precisely when we saw the Tea Party come up into the far right, and also the Occupy Wall Street movement come up in the far left. And of course, this changed the composition of our Congress, and those movements have waned a little bit as things have gotten a little better, but I'm not sure we're quite out of the woods yet.
That's Pete Hatamia, Penn State Associate Professor. We're talking about our politics. Are they in our genes? We're also talking with Avi Tushman, an evolutionary anthropologist. Our numbers, 888-477-9499. Tell us about your politics. Have they changed over time? And where do you believe your politics came from? Let's go right to the lines. We've got Paul on the line. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Dan.
Sure.
Good afternoon to you all. My question has to do with something that is very current, which is the denial of climate science. I'm trying to understand how it is that some people who seem to be very articulate, very well-read, able to use computers, nevertheless, when it comes to certain aspects of proven scientific reality, they choose to deny it, completely deny it. This also goes to the creationism thing, the demand that creationism be taught as equal to science in high schools. I guess it could be explained as just the preference of religion over anything else. But is there anything else? What is the psychodynamics of people who deny scientific reality in favor of some political position that they have adopted?
Well, I listened to your question, and I just feel so grateful that I'm not the expert on this show. that we have. Let me hand it over to you, Pete.
Well, there's so much going on there, and it's a multifaceted, multi-level problem that you're reaching at. So part of it certainly is religion and culture and the way we're raised. But one of the important things that we have found, and one of the greatest messages that we can bring out about why we differ in our DNA and how that difference is important, is that we really are different. That you can take two very articulate, intelligent, well-informed, reasonable individuals who on any domain you can interact with, but then you bring in politics or religion, and you've got these hard lines that you can't cross. And at one point of view, the kind of a liberal ideology thought, hey, as long as we provide with more information, these individuals will come to our side, if only we could teach them. And that's one of the messages that we put out that's actually not that way, that people really do differ in the way they see the world, the way they process information. A recent study with my good friend and colleague Rose, we did an eye-tracking study, which we took people on the ideological left and right, and we gave them a stimulus. Sometimes there were fearful pictures, sometimes disgusting images and so forth. And we can actually see that those on the left and right look at different parts of the exact same stimulus to form their opinion. So even though you would think they're seeing the same thing, they're really not. They're focusing on different aspects. Some people were focusing on the eyes of the victims, others on the threat. And that differed by left-right. And so we really do differ. It's not about teaching. It's not just about religion. It's not just about culture. It's not that they're stupid. It's that people on the left and right look at the world differently. They process information differently. And they come to different opinions. And no matter of information is going to change that.
Well, and we also know that, there's more research coming out now that the way we perceive our worldview, it is very difficult to change, and that becomes our reality. Our attitudes about things really determine the way we experience.
Certainly, yeah. We process information, we have a filter and a lens in which we shut down information that it's kind of a cognitive dissonance model. Milt Lodge and Chuck Tabor and others have built on this in Hot Cognition. And we'll take in information we had in the past, we'll add in information that fits with that preconceived notion and shut down all others. That's kind of the way our brain works.
You said on one of your YouTube interviews, you talked about a person trying to give more information to someone on the left or the right. It's like sitting at a dinner table and trying to give information to a vegetarian trying to convince him to eat meat.
Yeah, there's we'd like to think the world is simply just based on cognitive capacity or information, and we'd like to think that with reasoned discourse we can bring people to our side because we're right, whichever side that you're on. But probably the more important thing is, instead of focusing on who's right, is finding a place in the middle. And that was the earlier question that you had about the acrimony in political discourse, that you haven't seen it. It's happened a few times in America, but you have so many layers. You have structural problems with the presidential system versus the parliamentary system that increase acrimony. But you also have this divide that is two lines screaming at each other of who's right, instead of finding a spot in the middle that both can live with. And so ignoring the who's right debate and focusing on where you can go is probably more fruitful, but our structural system of presidential system actually represses that and focuses more on, one-liners in the media to kind of, get your message in. And social forces, social pressure, social emotions, social issues, they resonate so much more than reasoned discourse on things like economics. So better to attack your opposition on abortion than actually talk about having to deal with a stimulus package that has largely failed. And these are great questions, and I wish I had all the answers, but I can talk to pieces of it, but
You know what? I don't want you to explain it. I want you to fix the damn thing. Avi, in your book, you talked about personality characteristics that are actually predictive of political orientation.
Right. So one of those is called belief in a just world. And that's relevant to our listener's question about the denial of the climate science question. So as Pete mentioned, there is a religious component there. There are parts of Genesis that talk about God giving man dominion over the plants and the animals. And there's a perception among people who have a higher belief in a just world, or a more hierarchical way of looking at the world, that human beings are more powerful than nature. So when you have a conflict, a perceived conflict between the rights of nature and the rights of human beings, and in particular those who are wealthy or powerful, who have large companies, who are being criticized for their role in emitting carbon dioxide, certain people are more likely to side with one half of that equation and to turn a blind eye to the science, which is pretty unequivocal that climate change is occurring, as your listener pointed out.
So you're suggesting, this is really interesting to me, Avi, you're suggesting that these polluters are not just rationalizing bad behavior, that they truly believe that what they're doing is okay.
There's a bit of a gray line in politics between what people believe, whether it's a rationalization or not. The same thing happens in leadership, which is whether, say, a dictator will truly believe in the ideology that he's represents. And there's a gray line between that ideology and where does self-interest begin. So it's a bit hard to say. And it also relates to the phenomenon of self-deception. And in my book, Our Political Nature, there's a whole chapter all about self-deception, and there's another one about belief in a just world. And these are both very relevant topics to questions such as these.
So children who are likely, or people who are likely to believe in a just world, Are you suggesting they might land on the left or the right of the political spectrum?
The higher measurements of belief in a just world go up, the more likely someone is to take a politically conservative view, to be on the right of the spectrum. And so in the book, I explain how there's a whole set of different hierarchies. Even one, for example, would be acts of God, like a flood or a fire or an earthquake. So in Israel and in Iran, for example, we saw in the last couple of years a fire in the first case and earthquakes in the last case. And in both countries, religious clerics were saying that even this horrible act of destruction had a justification, which they claimed was the morality of the people. In the first case, because people in the victims of the fire weren't observing the Sabbath, and in the case in Iran, because women weren't dressing modestly enough. So that's just a concrete example of how a very conservative worldview that has a very high belief in a just world will find a reason for things. And it's the same kind of logic to some extent that has to do with people's view of a very large and powerful company, whether they're doing wrong or right. And of course, on the left of the spectrum, you have the exact opposite view, and it increases the further out you go to the far left, which is a belief in an unjust world.
What do you mean a belief in an unjust world? That's confusing to me.
What I mean is that if you have a conflict between a more powerful and a weaker party, that people on the left tend to side with the weaker party. And this comes up in issues like the debate about torture or the treatment of criminals. And in the book, so to give a clear example, the right tends to be more supportive of torture, and a left tends to side with who they perceive to be the weaker.
So you say, when you say belief in an unjust world, you're saying that people on the left believe the world is unjust.
Right. That's correct.
Okay.
To a much greater extent. And you know, I should emphasize these are all trends, and it's a spectrum, and I don't want to be too Manichaean here. But the most interesting thing about this belief in a just or an unjust world is that it doesn't correspond to economics. In fact, there are studies that show, in certain cases, that people who are lower socioeconomic status, so the poorest people in a population, actually are more likely to believe in a just world. And the higher you go up in income, the more people are willing to question whether the government leaders are going to do what is in their best interest.
Well, you just said a great deal that must be unpacked a bit. We've got to take a break, Avi, and we're going to talk more about this after our break. I also want to know what happens to political ideologies across the lifespan and across economics. We're talking about our politics, where they come from, how we got them, and are they changeable? If so, how? Our number here is 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines open. We'd love to hear from you. My guest, we were just talking to Avi Tushman. He's an evolutionary anthropologist, and his new book is called Our Political Nature, The Evolutionary Origins of What Divides Us. Pete Hatami is a Penn State University Associate Professor of Political Science, Microbiology, and Biochemistry, and he's co-author of Man is by Nature a Political Animal. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about our political nature. Where do our beliefs come from? We're talking with Avi Tushman and Pete Hatami, and our number is 888-477-9499. Avi, you cited a study in your book that I thought was fascinating. It was done in 1969 by Jack and Jean Block when they studied 128 nursery school kids. Tell us about that study.
Sure. This was a landmark study where these two psychologists had the crazy idea to look at the behavior of children as young as 4 years old and to see if there would be any correlation later on with their political identities at the ages of 18. So, of course, this is quite a rare study because it takes a long time to do, and they did wind up finding some very interesting correlations, and that since then another study has been able to replicate the findings to some extent.
So what were they? What did they find?
They found, for example, that later on at the age of 18, the subjects who were conservative in their political ideologies, that as preschoolers, they'd been described as uncomfortable with uncertainty and relatively over-controlled, and that the girls were quiet and neat and tended to wait for help from the adults around. Whereas the 18-year-olds who were liberal had been described as children as autonomous, expressive, and relatively under-controlled, and that the girls were more self-assertive, talkative, and open to expressing negative feelings.
How's that breakdown by gender?
By gender? The liberal girls were more self-assertive and talkative, right?
Yeah.
And conservative.
I wonder because, you know, you find often that it's the boys, you know, at this age that are the big mouths, you know, when we're studying a heterogeneous population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the boys tend to be the big mouths and wild, and the girls tend to be more conservative. So I wonder how that would look 20 years later.
So there's been a number of studies since the Block and Block study was kind of terrifically interesting, even though for the time it was trendsetting, but today it would be considered probably a small sample. But since then, a whole host of scholars have followed on and have done just enormous sample sizes, 60,000-70,000 children in junior high and preschool. And what they're finding, and I even had a study where we followed, I published a couple of years ago, children at age 9, we followed them to their 18. And what you're finding is that those same kind of orientations that they have very early in life, the way they play, the way they share their toys, if they don't share their toys, the way they're willing to take on new people that come into the group or shun them as outsiders, they start to reflect in their attitudes as early as you can measure them. And at age 9, we had a lot of missingness in our 50, 60 attitudes. You know, asking a 9-year-old about how they feel about gun control, you might get a response like, I like guns. for boys and girls would be, you know, shrug their shoulders. But as they got older, up until about age 15, their complexity of their attitude structure, like putting attitudes together with other attitudes, was the same as their parents. And we found no genetic differences in childhood. So a lot of it, you know, as far as the explicit political attitudes, we found that to be purely social. But then when they become adults and they leave the home, their attitudes in adult life tend to reflect those childhood orientations prior to them being able to declare them as political. And so what study upon study has found, and, you know, Avi mentions it a little bit, it sounds like you mentioned it in your book in a little more detail, is that those same kind of general proclivities children have, when they're allowed to express them in adulthood without the social pressure to conform to parents or their local society, they tend to be expressed just the same as in adulthood. So there's a really strong correlation all the way from early childhood to adulthood about what you'd be considered political as a two-year-old is, you know, sharing. That's correlated to how they feel about welfare and health care in adulthood.
It's not just leaving parents' home and getting on your own. You know, when you're between 18 and 22, a lot of genes get expressed for the first time. You know, as that's a time of rapid changes for brains.
Certainly, yeah. 15 is that cognitive structure kicks in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. Apropos of that, we've got Todd on the line. Hey, Todd.
Hey, how you doing? I am a conservative, and my philosophies come from my parents, who grew up in rural Pennsylvania, and it was a very strong belief in self-sufficiency. And they took care of themselves, and the people in that community took care of each other without government. And they really looked down upon the whole idea of the welfare state and people becoming dependent on government, because they believe that that was something that's very harmful to a democracy. It's when you have a large number of people becoming more and more dependent on government. So I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, so it's the question about nature and nurture here, and how much of it is the genetics you come in with, and how much of it is the environment you grew up in. So who wants to weigh in on that? Avi, how about you?
Sure. So one interesting thing that we found is that attitudes toward, say, government intervention and how much the government should be involved in economic issues or other ones, these attitudes don't connect or correlate very well with people's economic circumstances. To the contrary, what we find are parallel attitudes that people have in terms of how they feel about authority in the family, and also inequality in the family. So
give us an example, Avi.
For example, people who tend to side with the authority in the family. For example, there's a very interesting poll that came out about the 2004 election, where they looked at the approval for spanking a child. And every single one of the states that had an above the median approval for spanking a child voted conservatively in that election. And the similar attitudes correlate not with people's, you know, economic class or their incomes, but rather that we find much more similarities with the type of issues mentioned by the last caller about how government should be involved or not involved. So the argument I make in the book is that there are conflicts in the family, and these go back to the theories of evolutionary biologist Robert Trivers, and these conflicts don't necessarily have an answer. That's why most people are in the middle, and we do find people on the extremes. And when you do look at people's political orientations in a large population, you'll find them distributed normally in the bell-shaped curve, much like height, weight, or blood pressure, or basic personality traits. And when you look at income distribution, of course, it doesn't look anything like that. It's distributed, it's very skewed toward people of lower incomes. So what's going on are issues of personality, fundamentally, creating these predispositions. And the ones that have to do with inequality, whether it's in society or in the family, seem to be coming from the same place.
So what you're suggesting is James Carville was wrong when he said during one of Bill Clinton's presidential campaigns, when he said, it's the economy, stupid, according to...
No, actually, I would agree with that. And the reason is because most people, most voters, there's a base. And in our two-party system, the people who swing the vote are the swing voters. Now, one thing that I've heard from people who've worked with Bill Clinton was that it was a little bit tricky for him to understand, and it's counterintuitive to a lot of people. Sometimes we think of swing voters as highly sophisticated and weighing the evidence carefully, when in fact these are people in the middle of the curve who have oftentimes a low interest in politics. And there's a whole spectrum in our society, in any population, of what you'd call political coherence. And on one end, you have the political elites and the media and people with higher educations or high interest in politics who have a bit more coherent ideologies. And on the other end, you have people who can't name the vice president, don't follow at all, and aren't particularly interested. And swing voters tend to be more in that category. And, of course, there's a large proportion of people who don't even vote. But one step up, there are a number of people who are economic voters, and they're paying attention to how the economy is doing. And they'll tend to reward or punish the incumbent party, regardless of whether it's on the right or the left, based on economics.
I read that as people who live, who are on the lower end of the economic spectrum, are more likely to be at the extremes, liberal or conservative, and not predictable which side they will be on.
There is a bit of a paradox here, because there is a tendency when people are under more economic pressure, or in some situations, other types of stress, maybe in a conflict zone, of people to look for more extreme solutions. And that's why I mentioned before that as people rise into the middle class, the political spectrum will contract. However, there's another phenomenon going on at the same time, which is that the more education you have and or the more interest in politics, those also have a polarizing effect on people. That they might not be onto the as far to the extremes, but there's two different forces happening, and this is a big problem that we have in our country. So one of the things that I think is so wonderful about this book is that when people take a step back and contemplate the evolutionary origins of political bias itself, I found, and I'd be interested to hear Pete's experience here, but I found that it has a moderating effect on people, and that it opens us up to deeper understandings, and hopefully,
well, you said the two magic words, and you know, when I said jokingly earlier on, let's fix the damn thing, those are the two magic words: step back, which is very, very hard to do. So we've got to take another break. When we come back, we're going to go to the phones, and I want to know more about how we change over time. We're talking about our politics, and our political nature, and where they come from, how we got them, and do they change, and how. My guests are Avi Tushman, evolutionary anthropologist. He's written Our Political Nature, The Evolutionary Origins of What Divides Us. Pete Hatami is a Penn State University associate professor, and he's co-author of Man is by Nature a Political Animal. Our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? If this sounds familiar to you, you may qualify for a research study focusing on cognition and memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 45 and 60 to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. 215-41-STUDY.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about our political nature with Pete Hatami and Avi Tushman. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Sarah on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Yes. Hi, Dan. I had heard of a study about comparing conservatives and liberals in neuroscience. I haven't read the study, but it indicated, from what I understand, that very often ultra-conservatives tend to have a more activated limbic, the emotional brain, limbic system, including the amygdala, the fear center, compared to liberals that tended to have more activation in the cortical or thinking area. And I wondered, I'd love to hear some comments from your guests on that.
Yeah, actually, there is that study, and you did hear accurately. I forget, Pete... Pete, are you familiar with that study?
There's a few studies. That sounds a lot like my friend Darren's study, Darren Schreiber's red brain, blue brain study. But there's several others that kind of find similar evidence. And what we do find is that different processes in the brain that are roughly correlated to what you consider like your emotional centers or your cognitive centers. It's brain isn't that compartmentalized, but it's one way of thinking about it. That those tend to, either the left or the right, be more correlated with certain behaviors when you're engaged in certain stimuli. So if you're given, let's say, a stimulus that has uncertainty or risk, like maybe a gambling game, that liberals and conservatives may come towards similar solutions, but they would use, prefer, I would say the brain region would correlate strongly. I'm using very careful language here because in science, sometimes their findings get extrapolated too strongly, like this part of the brain is for conservative and that's for liberal, and that's not really the way it is. But it appears to be that the part of the brain that we believe to be more linked to the emotive center, particularly in fear response and stimulus, let's say the amygdala, that might be just slightly more correlated with a conservative decision-making when presented with a specific task. And for the PFC, the prefrontal cortex, more the cognitive compartment, slightly more correlated with liberals performing the same task. But keep in mind, we're talking very, very small differences. So it's not necessarily that, you know, people on the right are all fear-mongering and that's what they're using, and people on the left are all thought-provoking, that's what they're using. It's for specific stimuli, it seems to reflect that way.
Damn, you sure take all the drama out of this.
I know, yeah. I love watching the news briefs where there was one BBC reporter that claimed I found the gene for terrorism, and I had to call him up and really give him the riot act, saying that's just nonsense. And others, Fox News reported they found the liberal gene, and And of course, that's a bit silly. And you get the same thing with the press reports of the neuroscience studies. This part of the brain is linked for being Republican, and those are a bit silly too.
Speaking of genes, you know, I read what you guys had to say, you know, the books and the research, and it got me thinking about, you know, my DNA. And my family wasn't really all that political, although I am. But when I look back at their personalities, I would think one of my parents would be on the liberal side, the other would be on the conservative side. And now I'm thinking, maybe that's why I spent all these thousands of dollars in psychotherapy.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of studies on mate selection on the left and right. I've, you know, published with some of my co-authors, John Hibbing and John Alford, and then my good friend Nick Martin and Lyndon Eaves. And your parents would be considered more rare. Most couples they highly assort on political values. They're highly correlated in their ideological orientations. We find that those who don't are correlated with higher numbers of divorce. We find that people aren't, it's not by accident or just by the social background that selects someone more similar to them. They actually, by some process, go out of their way and find someone more politically similar than they are. And we also find that's linked by all sorts of biochemical signals, that people on the left prefer the smell of people on the left, and people on the right prefer even the smell of people on the right. So there's really just a whole host of research now focused on mate selection. And of all the human traits, and we've looked at thousands, the top two that people correlate on that are more similar are on politics and religion. Wow. Over everything else.
Wow.
So there's really something about that. Whether or not that's the reason why you went to therapy, I can't say, but
now you see
more stress in the home.
You're ruling that out. You're ruling that out. So now I'm just a garden variety neurotic.
No, but there is a great deal more stress in the home when parents differ politically. That's absolutely certain. So
you got to tell me, so what the hell's going on with James Carville and Mary Maitland? I mean,
I love that.
How do they do that?
That's our great couple that people always ask us about, and I can speculate without knowing them personally that it's their intensity and interest in politics trumps their different direction, and that's probably those two could probably never get tired of talking to each other about what's going on in the political world because their political interest is so high that might be what they assorted on above and beyond their orientation. And like you mentioned, most families, they care about politics when presented to them. If you ask them an opinion, they have one. But do they necessarily go out of their way to talk about politics? And that really differs amongst American families because it has to do with the environment they're in, their location, what's going on nationally. But if you ask them, they have an opinion. But if you don't ask them, don't bring it up, it doesn't come up.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mary on the line.
I was just wondering about the teenage brain and the rebelliousness that usually correlates to a change from the conservative to a liberal, and also fascinated with the aging brain. People tend to go from liberal to conservative as they get older. I was wondering if there was any studies you can cite, or there was recently a conference with Michael Novak, and he was fascinating. His whole change. He was a priest and he was a liberal at the time, and then at the end, towards the end of his life now, he's going conservative. He's not a priest currently, and it's just a fascinating. Can you cite any studies?
Yeah, there are plenty of studies. Avi, can you tackle this briefly?
Absolutely. So what Mary's mentioned corresponds to a popular saying. It affirms if you're not a liberal when you're 20, you have no heart. And if you're not a conservative by the time you're 30, you have no brain. And this has been attributed to a long list of politicians over the past couple of hundred years. And it raises a very fascinating question. And I dedicate two chapters to this question in the book. But in brief, we do find that when we look at people all around the world as they live through their 20s, what psychologists call openness drops and conscientiousness rises. These are some of the major dimensions used to describe human personality. And higher openness is a trait that we associate with voting for the left, irrespective of what country people are in. And higher conscientiousness predicts support for right-wing parties. Another thing we found is that the saying is correct about is that all around the world, people's levels of these traits, when you measure them between the ages of 18 and 22, they're significantly different than they are among older adults of all ages. So if your political personality hasn't changed by the time of your 30th birthday, it's not too likely to make a major shift at the time you're 40, 50, or 60. And this, of course, corresponds to changes in the brain. We used to think that the brain stopped developing after major changes in the body at puberty. However, now we know that there are major changes going on at puberty and then again in the mid-20s.
Pete, let me shift to you in just our last moment. But, you know, listening to what Avi says, this might explain why a lot of the major social changes in this country has been initiated by youth. I'm thinking of young people and civil rights and Vietnam and women's rights and gay rights.
In part, there's another element to that. While those brain changes, they're corresponding to life changes. And so they're never independent of one another. So if you think about what's happening in your 20s and maybe even early 30s, you're getting married and having children. What's happening later than that, you're paying taxes and you have mortgages. And so those needs to provide for your family, home, circumstance, those instigate entirely different biological processes.
They are focused more on self. Unfortunately, we're going to need to end on that note. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Really fascinating show.
No, it's great being here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Stan.
We've been talking with Pete Tushman and Pete Hatami about our political orientation. Well, we'd love to hear from you. Join us at whyy.org/voices. We're at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And you can reach me, of course, at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. And Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, have a great week, my friends.
This is